Chapter 6. Robin Baker was adopted at the age of 4 days by Ron and Alma Baker, a nice couple from Woodbridge, Virginia, who had opted not to have children on their own after a geneticist read their charts and found nightmare after nightmare of recessive genetics in their makeup. This may have had something to do with Ron and Alma Baker hailing from the same small town in downstate Virginia, where the same four families had been interbreeding almost exclusively for centuries, thereby reinforcing several undesirable genetic traits. Ron and Alma, while only nominally related on paper, had a genetic consanguinity somewhere between half-siblings and first cousins. Their geneticist declared this a neat trick and strenuously advised them against making any kids the old-fashioned way. This was just fine by Ron and Alma, who left their hometown precisely because they both considered the vast majority of their kin to be inbred freaks. Just because they weren't didn't mean they couldn't breed a new generation of freaks. So they weren't in a rush to have their sperm and eggs fuse and grow. But they did like kids, and they were nurturing by inclination. This led Ron and Alma to sign up with Prince William County as foster parents. This was how Robin came to them. The Bakers were told by the Prince William Child Protective Services that the little girl was the only child of a mentally deficient woman who had been used as a prostitute and who had died while giving birth. Ron and Alma, who were assured that the child was herself and always physically and mentally fit, instantly fell in love with the child, named her after a favorite aunt of Alma's, and started the adoption process immediately. They then proceeded to give their new daughter a perfectly pleasant and utterly unremarkable childhood. Outside of a broken arm in the fifth grade from falling out of a tree, Robin had no physical troubles of note. In high school and college, Robin did well, but not exceptionally, in academics, eventually earning a BA in business and a minor in biology from George Mason University, both of which she immediately applied by opening Robin's Pets with seed money provided by loving parents Ron and Alma. Creek breezed rather impatiently through the information about Ron and Alma. They were fabulous parents, which was great for Robin, but adoptive parents didn't tell him anything about Robin's genetics. He went rooting through Prince William County's sheriff reports for mentally deficient prostitutes and their pimps. He found a report that matched a search query and opened it, and then pulled up the photos of Robin's biological mother. "Holy Christ," he said. Robin's mother was photographed nude, front and side photos. Her breasts were large and swollen, as was her belly. She was clearly pregnant. Creek would have guessed 7 or 8 months. Her gravid torso gave way to limbs that tapered at the end, not to hands and feet, but to hooves that were clearly not designed to allow clean, bipedal motion. In the front-facing picture, she was supported by two police officers on either side, allowing her to stand. In the side picture, she hunched on all fours. Her limbs, of human proportions, balanced her awkwardly in this position as well. Any motion, two-legged or four-legged, would be difficult. Her front was smooth, either that way by nature or shaved for effect. Her back was thickly covered in electric blue wool. A human neck gave way to a sheep's head. From the front-facing picture, sheep's eyes gazed into the camera, placid, complacent. The police report provided details. Robin's mother had been found as part of a hybridized menagerie kept by Arthur Montgomery, chairman of ZooGen, the second largest provider of genetically modified pets and livestock in North America. Montgomery's personal estate featured a small but fully stocked biogenetics lab and factory in which Montgomery personally designed the hybrid creatures using livestock on the estate and gene samples that were later discovered to have been taken from members of ZooGen's board of directors, specifically shareholder-elected members who generally voted against Montgomery and his block of directors. In addition to Robin's unfortunate mother, other hybrids combined human genes with the genes of cows, horses, Jordanian, a ZooGen variation of the Arabian, and llamas. The hybrids had numerous human physical characteristics, but were no smarter than the animal breeds from which they originated. One would naturally assume that Montgomery had assembled this menagerie for his personal pleasure, but that assumption would be incorrect. Montgomery was straightforwardly and blandly heterosexual and took care of his needs with long-standing Tuesday and Thursday out-call appointments with the Washington, D.C. area's leading escort service. Montgomery's game was subtler than that. One doesn't work in the modified animals field without eventually becoming aware of the unsettlingly large number of zoophiles out there. Their numbers were hardly restricted to farm boys with access to alcohol and a herd of sheep. There were executives, legislators, and celebrities whose personal kinks ran from simple furry play, dressing up in animal costumes, to diddling the dog when they thought no one was looking. Over the years, Montgomery's personal web of corporate and government informers had provided him with a comprehensive list of who had what quirks and how they sated them. Montgomery's scheme against his victims was simple. Gain their trust, generally accomplished through business deals or PAC donations, introduce them to the menagerie, give them the one free taste that makes an addict, and then provide access in exchange for certain business and governmental favors. Usually this worked beautifully, and the occasional recalcitrant could be brought into line through the threat of exposure. Montgomery, of course, had an extensive video collection. All told, the scam worked nicely for Montgomery and, by extension, ZooGen for a number of years. It came crashing down, as things so often do, because Montgomery got greedy. Montgomery was blackmailing Zach Porter, the CEO of a small cosmetics company, and needed some additional leverage to convince Porter to use ZooGen's modified rodents for his company's animal testing. So he let the sheep hybrid get pregnant. Montgomery had specifically designed the hybrids with 23 chromosome pairs for just this sort of eventuality and tweaked the embryo with DNA and RNA therapies as it developed. He wasn't sure what the resulting creature would be, but no matter what it was, it wouldn't be good news for Porter, who had married into the cosmetic company's exceptionally Christian fundamentalist founding family. Montgomery expected Porter would fold and he would then abort the fetus. Montgomery wasn't expecting that Porter would counter the move by shooting him dead in his ZooGen boardroom and then kill himself with the next shot, which is what Porter ended up doing. Porter's suicide note led the Prince William County sheriffs to raid Montgomery's estate, where they found the menagerie and Montgomery's blackmail videos. There were unusually high numbers of prominent suicides in the D.C. area over the next few days. The pregnant sheep woman presented a problem. Prince William County health officials were inclined to abort the pregnancy, but Zach Porter's in-laws and widow threatened to file a lawsuit halting the procedure. Half sheep or not, life began at conception, and aborting the near-term fetus was wrong. The county, which wanted the whole thing to go away, took the in-laws up on their offer to pay for the medical needs of the pregnant sheep woman until she gave birth. The delivery a month later was presided over by both a doctor and a veterinarian, neither of whom could stop, or possibly was inclined to stop, the mother from bleeding out during the complicated delivery. A genetic scan showed the child's DNA to be mostly human, save for some junk sheep DNA apparently randomly positioned among the chromosomes. They declared her human and offered her to Porter's in-laws and widow. They refused her, saying she was no kin of theirs. Their interest in her did not extend past the fact and the moment of her birth. Porter's parents were already deceased, and at the time the human DNA donor of the sheep woman was unknown. The baby girl was declared an orphan and placed in the care of Ron and Alma, who were never told the full sordid story of the birth of their adopted daughter and therefore were never able to tell her anything meaningful about her past. Robin Baker had no idea she was anything but fully human. "That's some fucked up shit, Harry," Brian said as he passed along the information. "And I believe fucked up shit is indeed the technical term here." "I'm suddenly reminded that you were 18 when you had that brain scan," Creek said. "You have a better way of describing it then," Brian said. "No," Creek admitted. "You've pretty much hit the nail on the head." "What are you going to do now?" Brian asked. "I don't know," Creek said. "Finding our lost sheep has suddenly become a little more complicated. I have to think." "Think quick," Brian said. "You have an incoming call." "Who is it?" Creek asked. "Just you wait," Brian said, and put the call through. "Hi," Robin said. "It's Robin. Find your sheep?" "Funny you should ask," Creek said. "Listen, Robin, would you like to go out on a date?" Robin asked. "What?" Creek said. "A date," Robin said. "You know, two people go out and eat food and make small talk and wonder what each other look like naked. You have dated before." "Yes," Creek said. "Okay, so you know how it goes," Robin said. "Well, what do you think? I'm thinking tonight would be good." "It's kind of sudden," Creek said. "No time like the present," Robin said. You're cute, and I did a search on your name and came up with no outstanding warrants for your arrest. That's good enough for dinner in a public place. Creek grinned. All right, he said. Where would you like to meet? Arlington Mall, Robin said. You want to eat in the mall? Creek said. Oh, no, Robin said. I'm a cheap date, but not food court cheap. But there's something there I'd like to try out. Actually, you should try it out with me. Ever play basketball? Sure, Creek said. No bum knees? Robin asked. Not yet, Creek said. Perfect, Robin said. Meet me at the west entrance then. Ground floor, 7 o'clock. Dress casual. Bye, she clicked off. That's going to be an interesting date, Ryan said. I need you to connect me with Ben, Creek said. Ben as in my brother Ben, Brian said. That's the one, Creek said. Interesting, Brian said. I don't suppose he knows about me. I have to tell him that the sheep we're looking for is a woman who runs a pet store, Creek said. I think telling him his younger brother's been resurrected as a computer program might be a little much for one day. Archie almost missed the connection between Robin and the sheep. The Rod-ordered background check offered nothing of interest. A long-term scan of her business record showed her ordering a sheep only once in the history of her store, and it was a common breed, not something genetically modified. Archie kept going back in Robin's history, past the point of boredom, until he was presented with an electronic version of the very first document of Robin's life, her birth certificate. It listed Jane Doe as the mother and Zach Porter as the father. Archie moved to close out all the documents, then hesitated. Somewhere in the back of his head, the name Zach Porter fired up some neurons. Archie decided this would be a good time for a break. I'm going to get a snack, he said to the room. Anybody want anything? Ed, the other guy, barely looked up from his show and shook his head. Talk was still out of it. Rod and his crew were camped out in a shitty apartment, in a shitty complex, in a shitty part of town. Rod's apartment was jacked up with some serious equipment, which Archie would have suspected to be mighty tempting to the local scum. But he also noticed, on his couple other times out, that the local population gave the door of Rod's apartment a wide berth. Being a scary motherfucker meant no one messed with your shit. The vending machine was at the end of the hall, next to the stairs. The sticker in the top right corner of the display case read, Ross Vending, Inc. Inside the display case was a truly interesting assortment of vendables, from small cartons of LSL milk, irradiated for a 6-month shelf life, to 3 packs of Whisper brand condoms with patented electro-ecstatic molecule binding technology to make the condom membrane as thin yet impermeable as possible. Archie had never tried that particular brand. Something about the combination of an electric charge and his genitals just didn't seem appealing. Slot B4 held a small bag of white chocolate M&Ms. Archie smiled. Those were, in fact, pretty tasty. He slipped in his credit card and pressed the button. It felt like someone had stabbed him directly in both eyeballs. Archie crumpled, banging his head on the vending machine on the way down. As his forehead jammed against the vending machine plexiglass, the rattle of the impact dislodged information about Zach Porter. Archie finally remembered why he remembered that name. He spent a couple more minutes on the ground, gathering his strength, before he wobbled back up and headed back towards the apartment. About 3/4 of the way there, he realized he'd forgotten his snack. He went back to get it. Back at the computer, Archie pulled up news stories relating to Zach Porter. And there it was. Porter involved in a murder-suicide involving Arthur Montgomery. Of course, Archie knew the name Arthur Montgomery very well. If a religious organization as laid back and nebulous as the Church of the Evolved Lamb could be said to have an apostate member, Montgomery would have been it. In one of the few real church scandals on record, Montgomery had joined the church, worked his way into the top ranks of the church's genetic hybridization concern on Brisbane Colony, and then snuck off back to Earth to form ZooGen using church genetic techniques. Montgomery had gambled that the church would back off rather than sue him and have its entire genetics organization and its goals hauled into court and into the papers. The gamble paid off. The church's genetics program was not a high-priority enterprise in a commercial sense. Its goals were esoteric and long-term, and the ironists who ran Hader Rost didn't want anything to rock the business end of their organization. And in any event, one of Dwellin's more maddeningly vague prophecies suggested that something like this was supposed to happen. The church officially let it go, although it suggested to its individual members that they might consider investing in ZooGen stock since Montgomery had stolen some very advanced and likely profitable techniques. So, in one of those nice little ironies, church members soon comprised the single largest voting bloc of shareholders. After Montgomery's murder, they worked quietly to install a church-vetted executive as the new CEO. Several years later, ZooGen's executives and board voted to be acquired by Hayter Ross. This was quickly approved by the shareholders and by the FTC, which saw no conflict, as outside of livestock, Hayter Ross had been to that point a marginal player at best in the bioengineering field. Like many church members, Archie was aware of the scandal that led to Montgomery's murder and how he tried to blackmail Porter. The sheep woman Montgomery had hybridized had been a horrifying use of genetic engineering. But with all the documents laid out in front of him, Archie began to suspect for the first time what the connection between the pet shop lady and the android's dream sheep was. Archie called up Robin's insurance records to get the name of her provider, snuck into their system to grab her DNA map, and ran it through the processor. "Oh boy," he said after the comparison was done. Then he called out to Rod Acuna. "You're shitting me," Acuna said to Archie a few minutes later. "It's all there," Archie said. "She's mostly human, but there's whole sequences of her DNA which are from your sheep genome." "She didn't look like a sheep," Acuna said. "Looks like most of the sheep DNA is in areas of the code that are switched off in humans," Archie said. "It's called junk DNA. It wouldn't affect the way she looked or how her body worked. Functionally, she's totally human. But according to this DNA, she's about 18% sheep." "Fucking scientists," Acuna said. "Ruin a perfectly good-looking woman like that." He flipped open his communicator and made a call. "The hell you say," Secretary of State Heffer said to Ben Jovna over the communicator. "No joke, sir," Jovna said. "Our sheep is a pet shop owner from Virginia." "That's it?" Heffer said. "You don't have any other sheep? Real ones?" "That's all we got," Jovna said. "All the real Android's Dream sheep are dead from sabotage. Whoever's killing them off is moving fast." Heffer rubbed his temples. "Well, crap, Ben, this is all we need." "Where are you, sir?" Jovna asked. Heffer looked out the window of the Delta, which was just starting the downslope of its parabola. "Hell if I know," he said. "Most of the Pacific Ocean looks like any other part. We'll be landing in LA in about 45 minutes, and then I've got to make an appearance at the State Department building. The director there is retiring. I get back into D.C. around midnight your time." "What do you want to do?" Jovna asked. "What are our options?" Heffer asked. "None that I can think of right off the top of my head," Jovna said. "DNA aside, this is a human being and a U.S. and UNE citizen. We can't hand her over to the Nidu for a ceremony without her consent." "Can't we just give them a quart of her blood or something?" Heffer asked. "I don't think a quart of blood is an unreasonable request to make." "I'm pretty sure they need a whole sheep," Jovna said. "That's the impression I got when I called over to the Nidu embassy to ask about details. I was also given the impression that they're getting antsy about it. We're coming up to the deadline real soon." "You didn't tell them about her?" Heffer said. "No," Jovna said. "I figured you might want to be advised first." "Arg!" Heffer said, saying the word arg rather than grunting it. "Well, this development is pretty much par for the course, isn't it?" "Sorry, sir," Jovna said. Jovna had been following the transcripts and reports coming back from his boss's trip to Japan and Thailand. To say the trip had taken a bad turn would be to imply that there had been the possibility of taking the right turn somewhere along the way. Heffer had been hoping to get immigration concessions from the two countries to allow more colonists from third world countries to jump to the front of the colonization line. But Asian countries were chronically touchy about their colonization status and quotas. Both Japan and Thailand, in their diplomatically polite way, had told Heffer to stick it. The trip had not been one of his shining moments. "Look," Heffer said. "At the very least, we can have her come in and talk to us. We might be able to find some way to compromise with the Nidu if we can get her to agree to help out. And if nothing else, we can show the Nidu we're making the effort. We need that. Do you think your guy can get her to cooperate?" "He's got a date with her in an hour or so," Jovna said. "He can ask her then." "A date?" Heffer said. "Christ, Ben." He was sort of steamrolled into it, Jovna said. And anyway, the woman doesn't know that she's part sheep. He's got to break it to her. Not the usual first date conversation, is it? Heifer said. I've had first dates that would have been improved by it, Javna said. Well, as have we all, Heifer said. But that doesn't make his job any easier. No, sir, Javna said. Are we worried about her? Heifer asked. We've got a lot of dead sheep. We're pretty sure whoever's knocking off the sheep aren't aware she's out there, Javna said. If they did, I think she'd probably be dead by now. Ben, he needs to bring her in, Heifer said, for her own safety, if nothing else. It's not going to be easy, Javna said. At the risk of sounding melodramatic, it's a lot to lay on someone in one night that she's part sheep, her life's in danger, and she's needed by the government for the purposes of interplanetary peace. We don't have any options, Ben, Heifer said. You said it yourself. All right, Javna said. I'll get him to get her to come in. Can he do it? Heifer asked. Javna laughed. Sir, this guy breaks bad news to people for a living, he said. Trust me, we've got the best man for the job. I need to tell you something, Creek said to Robin as they walked through the Arlington Mall. It's not about the sweats, is it? Robin said, glancing down at her togs and then back at Creek. I know they're kind of ratty, but they're really comfortable, and being a pet shop owner doesn't exactly leave you rolling in the dough. I hadn't noticed your sweats, Creek said. He was wearing a jacket, t-shirt, and jeans. I don't know how to take that, Robin said. Does that mean you're not noticing me? If so, this date's not going like I hoped. Creek grinned. I've noticed you. Honest. Good answer, Robin said. What do you do, Harry? I work for the State Department, Creek said. I'm a xenosapien facilitator. Robin rolled that around in her head. You help non-human intelligences? That sounds like you're either a god or a gigolo, which could be really interesting or disgusting. It's neither, Creek said. I go to the various alien embassies and give the people in them bad news. Robin scrunched up her face. Rough gig. It takes a certain perspective, Creek agreed. So, do you have any bad news for me? Robin asked. Well, Creek began. Look, here we are, Robin said, and pointed to the 35-foot-high transparent cube in the Arlington Mall atrium. Creek peered inside the cube and saw four people in it, literally bouncing off the walls. What is that? Creek asked. That's wall ball, Robin said. It's why we're here. Wall ball? Creek said. I played that in third grade. You threw a tennis ball against a wall, and when it came back, you caught it. If you dropped it, you had to make it to the wall before someone threw it. That's wall ball. Well, two things, Robin said. First, that game's called suicide, not wall ball, and anyone who thinks otherwise is freakish and wrong. Second, you notice the banner over there has wall ball with that little TM thingy, so I'm sure that any little kids playing suicide but calling it wall ball will soon be served with cease and desist orders. Seems a little harsh, Creek said. You know kids, Robin said. If you don't keep them down early, they get all uppity. Come on, the line's short. Let's get in there. Robin explained the game while they waited. The game was played similarly to basketball in that you had to get the ball through a hoop in order to score. The catch was that the hoop was 28 feet up on the wall of the cube, high enough to make any ground-based shot at the hoop dubious at best. So the players literally climbed the walls of the playing field to get at the hoop, through the use of specially equipped sneakers with kinetic movement enhancers in the soles. As Robin was mentioning this, Creek was watching one of the players hurl himself at a wall, squarely plant a shoe, and then push off, hurling himself up an adjoining wall. When he hit that, he launched himself again, landed next to the hoop, and stuffed the ball down its gullet before doing a flip in the air and falling back first toward the flooring surface below. The surface gave under the speed of the impact and then bounced him back up. He put himself in standing position and landed on his feet. That's why people don't get killed, Robin said. The flooring is velocity sensitive and it dampens impacts. It's also why you have to kick off from the wall to get any speed out of the shoes. Been reading up on this? Creek said. You bet, Robin said. That guy who just stuffed the ball used to be with the Terrapins. The guys who invented the sport are going all over the U.S. with former college and pro players and letting people play 5 minutes of two-on-twos with them. They're trying to generate some excitement for the pro league they're starting next year. There was a loud smack as one of the players rammed into the wall, the ball squirting out from between him and the glass. He fell to the floor in obvious pain. I'm guessing that guy wasn't a former Maryland star, Creek said. Another player grabbed the ball and began hiking up toward the basket. Watching the amateurs hurt themselves is half the fun, Robin said.
You're forgetting. We're the amateurs, Creek said.
Look at it this way, Robin said. We can't possibly do any worse. The two men in front of Creek and Robin in the line stepped aside. Creek and Robin stepped forward to the attendant.
Welcome to Wall Ball, the world's most exciting new sport. I'm Chet.
Chet, despite being at the vanguard of the world's most exciting new sport, sounded suspiciously bored.
Do you want to challenge the sport's best pro players in two-on-two combat? He asked in the same near monotone.
Are those guys in there really the sport's best pro players? Robin asked.
Lady, at this point, they're pretty much the only pro players, Chet said. So, technically speaking, yeah, they're the best.
I don't see how we could resist a pitch like that, Robin said to Creek. She turned back to Chet. Okay, we're in.
Chet handed both of them disclaimer sheets. Please read and sign, he said. What are your shoe sizes? They told him.
He went over to a small storage kiosk to get their game shoes.
It says here that by playing, we waive our right to sue for any injury, quote, including but not limited to contusions, broken bones, lost teeth, paralysis, impacted spinal columns, and accidental removal of fingers, Creek said.
No wonder they think it's going to be popular with the kids, Robin said.
You got a pen?
You're going to sign this? Creek said.
Sure, Robin said. I'm not really worried about it. I'm pretty athletic, and if worst comes to worst, I know some good lawyers who will be all over this document.
I don't have a pen on me, Creek said.
Robin peered at Chet's stand to look for a pen. There wasn't one. Then she crossed her eyes in annoyance.
Geez, that's right, she said, and fished through her purse, eventually pulling out a pen. Here we go. It's the pen that guy left at the store today. I forgot I had it.
She signed the disclaimer and handed the pen to Creek.
Live a little, she said.
Creek signed the disclaimer and handed the paper and the pen back to Robin. She gave the papers back to Chet, who had returned with the shoes.
Okay, I need to explain to you how these shoes work, Chet said. He held up one of the shoes. Inside the shoe, near the tip, is a small patch at the top of the shoe. What you do is lift your big toe to come in contact with that patch. When you do that, you activate the jumping mechanism. The jumping mechanism only stays active for a second. That's for your safety, so you'll need to touch the patch each time you want to jump. There are patches in both shoes, but each activation works for both shoes at the same time, so use whichever big toe you're most comfortable with. Depending on how hard you push off, you can get about 20 feet into the air. The floor is designed to cushion a descent from any height, but you can still land awkwardly or collide with a wall. So, before the game starts, you'll get a couple of minutes to work with the shoes and get comfortable with them. Do you have any questions?
If we win, do we get anything? Robin asked.
You get 2 tickets to a regular season game, Chet said.
Cool. Second date for free, Robin said to Creek.
Chet looked at the two of them. You look like responsible adults instead of the brain-dead teenagers I've been dealing with, so I'm going to let you have these shoes now rather than wait until you're in the cube. But on the off chance you're tempted to run off with them, you should know that their jumping mechanism cuts off 50 yards from this station, so don't think you're going to be able to bounce all the way home.
Do kids really take off in them? Robin asked.
2 attempts today, Chet said. The mall security people hate us.
We promise not to run off, Creek said.
I appreciate that, Chet said. Okay, let me get this other pair set up and then you'll be up after them. Another 10 minutes or so. You can take your own shoes and put them next to this stand.
Chet walked off to deal with his other customers. Robin sat to put on her shoes. Creek leaned against a decorative light pole, slipped off his loafers, and slipped on the wall ball sneakers. As he put one on, he lifted up his big toe to feel for the patch. It was there, a small, slick circle he could register through his sock. He pressed his big toe into it and felt both of his shoes vibrate. He held still so as not to trigger a jump. A little less than a second later, the vibrating stopped.
You know, these look like the coolest bowling shoes ever, Robin said, standing up. I don't think I'd wear them for social occasions. I mean, beside this one. But they have their kitsch appeal. So, what do you want to do for dinner?
I thought you were the cruise director for this date, Creek said.
Oh, no, I'm really bad at that, Robin said. I don't know if you've figured this out yet, but I'm sort of both spontaneous and disorganized. And yet you own your own business, Creek said. Well, Dad's a CPA, Robin said. He helped get me organized and keeps me on an even keel. I don't know what I'd do without him. I wish I could have inherited his organizational mind, but I'm adopted, so I just have to borrow it straight from the source. I'd have to guess one of my biological parents was sort of scatterbrained. Have you ever tried to find out anything about your biological parents? Creek asked. Robin shrugged. My adoptive parents, told me that they had died, she said. And aside from a bad moment with Santa when I was 8, they've never lied to me about anything big, so I never went looking. There were a couple of times when I was a teenager when I thought about what it would be like to meet my other family, though. And you know how teenagers are. I was one once, Creek said. I'm sorry, Robin said. I suddenly got very personal for a first date. I don't want you to think I'm one of those people who unloads their entire history over appetizers. I'm really not that codependent. It's okay, Creek said. I don't mind. Anyway, I think we'll have a lot to talk about at dinner. Robin opened her mouth to follow up on that, but before she could, a man in a sports coat walked over. Robin Baker? He said. Yes, she said. The man reached into his coat and pulled out a wallet containing an ID card. Agent Dwight, FBI. Miss Baker, I need you to come with me. You're in danger here. In danger? Robin said. In danger from what? Not from what. From who? Agent Dwight said, and glanced over at Creek. You're in danger from him. He's going to kill you, Miss Baker. At least, he's going to try.